I'm Tim Waters. I've lived in this community for 24 years. I am in this campaign, for whatever it's worth, the only candidate who's been endorsed by the Sierra Club. Proud of that endorsement. More that you might want to know about me, you can find on my website for this campaign, timwatersforward1.com. There's a bio and position on issues, whatever you might want to know, and if you're interested and haven't seen it, you can learn probably what you want to know there. Here are the other things that you might want to know about me, in addition to reading my bio on a website. If elected to this position on the council, here's what you get. You're going to get somebody who will bring a fair amount of clarity on where I stand on issues. I've been, I think, clear from the beginning on the website. In my view, you deserve to know where I stand. I'm applying for a job with you. You deserve to know where I stand on the issues. So I've tried to be clear on those issues. Not that I'm not willing to learn as we go along, because I've learned a ton through this campaign. Number two, you're going to get a fair amount of transparency. How I arrive at a conclusion, and maybe more importantly, how I would arrive at a decision, especially with other council members. Having been in governing roles and in executive roles for my entire professional life, it's always been important to me to have no black boxes in terms of how decisions are made, how you arrive at conclusions, and what the implications are. Thirdly, you're going to get a fair amount of accountability, because I've lived my professional life in a space where it's really important, required in fact, essential, to be clear on where we want to go, with a goal and a set of objectives, strategies for getting there, assessing how effectively we're executing strategies, evaluating progress, which means collecting data and looking at performance against performance targets, and then adjusting and getting smarter as we go along, kind of a virtuous, continuous improvement cycle. And in my view, that's something every organization can use more of, and I think that's something that the city and the council in particular could benefit from. And lastly, you're going to get a fair amount of leadership. I've been in leadership roles for my entire professional life, both in public and private sectors, and I look forward to bringing some of that leadership to the council. So it's Tim Waters. Look forward to your support and look forward to the evening. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Tim. Perfect. Josh Goldberg, two minutes.
Sure. Well, hi, gang. Thanks for being here today. Thanks to all the folks who helped put it on. I'll just ditto what Tim said there. I'm Josh Goldberg. I am one of this town's most loyal advocates. I've been committed to elevating the Longmont story now for over a decade. And most importantly, I am not a politician tied to a political party. I am pro-Longmont, and I see this town as a wealth of opportunities, not a list of problems. Now at home, I'm the father of twin girls that are 3 years old and married to a wife, Wendy, the love of my life, who's a veterinarian right here in town. Professionally, I've been working at Left Hand Brewing Company for over 10 years as the community organizer, putting on large-scale events, most of them at Roosevelt Park, that have done a really good job waving the flag proud that Longmont is a wonderful place to be and to live. And even more importantly, they've raised the better part of $1 million for nonprofits that you care about right here in town. Think of one that you care about right now. Yep, we probably help them out. Beyond the events, I have about 10 years of experience in real-world, boots-on-the-ground governance here in Longmont, impacting this town that we all love. I've been on the Chamber of Commerce Board for 5 years, the Public Policy Committee for 9 years, and was the chair of that a number of years ago. I've been on the board on the Planning and Zoning Commission now for 6 years, and was even on the board of Visit Longmont before it was called Visit Longmont, as our local tourism bureau. I'm a graduate of a program called Leadership Longmont, and I was even nominated one of the top young business professionals here in Boulder County. Let me give you my first few things I want to make sure you know. First, I recognize that this isn't about me. This is about what's best for Longmont. Putting our town's interests before mine is an honor for me, and I practice that every month when I walk into the council chambers for planning and zoning. Second, I respect that I'm not the expert on the issue all the time. I take great consideration and from feedback and guidance from city staff, from the public, from consultants, from experts, and I'll continue to do that on council. Third, I'm committed to making sure everyone is heard. If you've ever watched a Planning and Zoning Commission meeting, you'll see that I write down every name of the member of the public that speaks. And at the end, most importantly, when we're about to give our decision, I'm going to address each of their concerns and make sure they're heard. This is critical. I have a reputation for being a consensus builder, even when the pressure's on in those council chambers. And the bottom line is that my hands-on experience in Longmont governance makes me uniquely qualified to be your next council member. I'm Josh Goldberg. Thank you.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you both so much. And I will alternate back and forth with who answers the questions first. And I will start with you, Tim. And this question concerns the topic of renewable energy. The Longmont City Council, as I'm sure you're aware, recently adopted a goal to achieve 100% renewable energy for the city of Longmont by the year 2030. What steps will you take to implement energy conservation and transformation here in Longmont so that that 2030 goal is attainable?
So let me first commend the mayor and the council for taking the action. It's the right thing to do. It is absolutely the right thing to do. All the data are clear that the long-term future of every community is going to be tied to this transformation to renewable energy. For whatever it's worth, when I was engaged professionally, I chaired the National Renewable Energy Laboratory Education and Public Outreach panel for half a dozen years or so. I was on it when it was created. I chaired it most of the years of its existence. So I've been in the middle of educating, of outreach and educating the world about the trajectory and the importance of renewable energy for a decade. So in my view, the important first step to set the goal of 100% renewable by 2030, now what the council needs to do is to get real clear on what's the plan for getting to 100% renewable, use of 100% renewables by 2030. So I'll be looking, whether I'm on the council or not, I'll be looking for what that plan looks like in terms of objectives over maybe a two-year cycle from now until 2030, knowing what the baseline performance is now, what's it going to take on a two-year cycle or on an annual cycle to get to 2030. There's going to be data that's critical, and then measuring progress and then making adjustments as we go along. The city itself is going to have to set the example. And then along with that, there's going to be a collection of opportunities, I think, in the development community and in the residential community to begin to follow that lead and for all of us to make those adaptations as we go along.
Thank you. And Josh, do you want to answer the question?
Sure.
Do you want to repeat it?
Yeah. Yeah, as it relates to the sustainable renewable energy, excuse me, I too would like to applaud Marsha Martin and Joan Peck and our current council for moving us forward towards that goal of 100% renewable energy. And I too will continue to do whatever I can to help keep that ball rolling. In fact, I was on the phone today with Mayor Brian Bagley and said, Brian, I'm going to hold your feet to the fire here. We need to make sure we get there, and thank you for taking a step in that direction. I think we have a lot to learn as it relates to renewable energy moving down the line. We have a couple factors that have to help us get to 100% renewable energy. We're going to continue to watch the price of solar and wind drop. And hopefully we're going to watch the technology develop to help us with necessary batteries. That technology will improve and the cost of that will drop. And I think it'll take partnerships and working with Platte River Power and Authority. They're working in our favor. They're taking big steps with their recent 150 kilowatt hour purchase that'll get us to 48% before you know it. And we're going to just continue having Platte River work on our behalf, hold our mayor accountable, and take these steps cautiously, and not cautiously, but intentionally as we move forward to the future.
Would you like to rebut Mr. Goldberg's comments?
No, okay. That was brilliant. Good answer.
Good. We're done.
Josh, any follow-up there? Okay. Josh, any follow-up back that way? Okay. I'm just wondering the specific steps. I mean, I get that you guys are behind the plan and that, looking ahead and, that goal is out there 2030. But, I mean, I think the question asked for some specific steps that you would take to get that going. Sure, yeah.
So I mentioned earlier setting goals and strategies. Among the strategies would be working hand in glove with the Power Authority. We know that we're going to see additional production of renewable energy. Storage is going to come along. Whether or not there's incentives for developers and for homeowners, I suspect there might be as part of that strategy to accelerate the adoption, early adoption at the residential level. I think there ought to be incentives in terms of green development for developers, whether it's new construction or remodeled construction. And then paying real close, working closely with the authority itself to know what we can do as a city to accelerate the adaptation.
Great. Thank you so much, Tim. Anything further on that, Josh?
No, not really. thank you. One of my strengths is that I recognize that I'm not the expert on all issues, but what I do have are relationships that help me get to the best answers. And so I don't know what the next step would be, but I sure look forward to working with the right players. And a couple of those players are in the room right now, and I think those steps will reveal themselves.
Okay, very good, thanks. So moving on to the second topic, which is social equity. And this is one of the pillars of sustainability, which is a socially equitable society that has a promise of inclusivity. And Suzanne mentioned this early on. What steps would you take to ensure that all citizens of Longmont, all backgrounds, income levels, have the opportunity to participate in decision-making around these sustainable issues, as well as opportunities to enjoy some of the fruits of the efforts to make Longmont an enduringly beautiful and sustainable city? So let's start with Josh first on that.
Thank you. Yeah, this is a big, this is an opportunity for us to really elevate this town. Right now, about 30% of our population is Latino, and we see less than 2% of that representation on our volunteer boards and commissions by the Latino community, and we see 0%, zero on our school board. And so there's a big opportunity here to engage and work with our cultural brokers to better engage with and better include our diverse community in these discussions. As it relates to just equity, the foundation has to be everyone has to feel safe and secure and have the opportunity to thrive in our town. So to that end, I believe that I am a proponent of DACA, and so we need to make sure our residents here feel safe. Folks are concerned with being sent back home. I also to a home that never was theirs. I believe that another step towards that would be making sure we are behaving like a sanctuary city, so that we are not cooperating with ICE as far as turning people in or detaining folks longer than we should. So once we set the condition that this is a safe, inclusive place to live, then engage and start hearing from our minority community, hearing their voices on boards and commissions, on school boards and what have you, then we can start working and hearing from them directly on how we can better serve and bring them to the table as it relates to renewable energies and moving forward.
Thanks, Josh. Tim Waters.
It would seem to be that the initially there's a lot of listening, and I know there's a lot of listening going on now. But listening to leaders across the community to identify what both the challenges are and what the opportunities are from their perspectives, specifically to increase their voice, to increase the influence they would have at a policy level and an operational level in the city and in other opportunities in the city. Some of this, I think, starts with how we think about development. If we're serious about sustainable development, then the whole concept, which is in the center of the sustainability plan, of the triple bottom line, with social equity being one of those three legs of sustainability, we have to move from talking about it to actually bringing the evaluation scales to life that are in that plan. So whether it's new development, whether it's program development or physical development, we can actually evaluate what kind of progress we're making with one third of that triple bottom line being social equity. All right, that's a great concept. We have to make it more actionable or operational in the life of the city. I think affordable housing, which is tied to that, is part of the social equity agenda as well. And we all know what a challenge that is. My guess we'll get questions tonight on affordable housing, and we'll go into it more deeply. But if our young families and our diverse families cannot afford to buy homes and raise their families in Longmont, the future of the city is not very bright. A vibrant city is going to find ways to support, as a matter of just common cause, the common good, that we can support young families in ways that I don't think we are right now, to live and raise their families and contribute to the economy for decades in this community. I'm out of time.
Okay, thanks. And Josh, do you want to rebut or respond to that?
Sure.
Yeah, I just think to continue the discussion, there's a couple more issues we want to be aware of. First of all, everyone in our community deserves to have a good enough paying job that allows them to get home and be in time for dinner and put the kids to bed. And so working on finding those jobs, working on job training, working with the Latino Task Force, working with the Latino Chamber of Commerce to help better enable and empower our Latino community to earn those good jobs and so that they can be an equal member of the community. Engaging in multicultural task force, whether issued by the city or by the school district. It's my understanding there is not a multicultural task force in the St. Vrain Valley School District. I met with Don Haddad this morning, and I think this is something that we should be moving forward with. I echo Tim's concern about transportation. This is critical. And then as it relates to safety and ease of being a part of our community, we need to have more bilingual officers that can help break down the fear of authority.
You have a minute, too, if you'd like.
I'll take another minute. We all know how important it is to get people involved in the committee and council structure in the city. And I know that the city council itself is constrained to some degree by who applies, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be doing outreach with employers, with members of the chamber, with employers in the community, with the school district, with the county, to encourage their employees to pay attention to what those opportunities are, and then encouraging an increasingly diverse, age-wise, ethically, and racially, individuals who would be willing to step forward and be encouraged to do so, to participate in the committee and council structure. I think the city ought to set the example for what a living wage means in this community, and unless the city of Longmont is willing to set the mark, it's hard to expect others to follow that lead, but I think the city ought to be a leader in what it means to employ people on their payroll with a living wage.
Okay, thanks so much. Moving on to the just marginal, minor topic of water and water conservation. I don't have to even preface water as a subject of great concern and certainly topical right now. But what of all the, given the expansion of Longmont, the growth of the city, people coming here, how would you best, or what conservation means or methods do you think would most effectively balance the needs of a growing community with concerns about conservation and future access to water? And I think that we're starting with Tim.
To begin with, I think the city has to set the example for what it means to conserve, specifically with xeriscaping, in particular with landscape. So any new city-owned property, the landscaping ought to be xeriscaped. We ought to be retrofitting, unless it's, a ball field, but to the degree that we can, city-owned property, so it models what it means to conserve water. Going forward, I know there are, and I'm not a hydrologist, I'm not a water engineer, But as I've sat in and listened to some of the presentations from staff about more efficient use of gray water for when it comes time to watering and taking some of the pressure off of what we need to do in terms of water treatment. And then outreach efforts and potentially incentives for new residences and existing residents to convert from green lawns to xeriscape.
Okay. Josh.
Thank you. I'd like to start just by first applauding the residents, the voters, for approving the adoption or the Windy Gap, collecting Windy Gap up to 10,000 acre feet. And I think the city council made a good decision going with 8,000 acre feet. And this will help us secure water for the future. I understand that will have an impact on rates for folks. And if there's good sound evidence in the future to lower from 8,000 down to 6,000 acre feet, then we could have that discussion. But I haven't seen that yet. So again, I just want to applaud city council. In regards to that, the best thing we can do that ties to conserving water is make sure that we're holding on to our water. So we should not be selling our water to oil and gas, and anything that we can do to codify our ordinance and confirm that the opportunity to sell to oil and gas is off the table, then I'll be supportive of that. And then the follow through would be seeing change throughout our city government and residences conserving water. I've grew up in San Diego, and in San Diego we had water days and non-water days. These are all things that we could discuss in the future, and I would look forward to having those discussions.
Thanks, Josh. Tim, any follow-up?
Yeah, I will. So what Josh and I would be in agreement. I think this is the first time we may have been in agreement that the city did, the council did the right thing in rolling back the decision that the previous council made to firm 8,000 acre feet in the Chimney Hollows project. So good on the council for doing that and saving this community $36 million. We own as much water today as we did, you know, before when the decision was made to secure 10,000 acre feet. Had the council, I'd say it this way, I wish the council, when passing the ordinance to prohibit the sale of water to oil and gas operators, had added that ordinance could not be rescinded without a vote of the people. That addition or that amendment to that ordinance, I think, would have inspired confidence in a bunch of us to be more supportive of the Windy Gap or the Chimney Hollow question. But we all ought to be paying attention, even though we have an ordinance that prohibits the sale of water to operators. We sell excess water today, one of which
That's
has
time.
Sold water to oil and gas operators.
Sorry, excuse me. So in addition to these 10 topics that we have, and we've just gone through three of them, renewable energy, social equity, water conservation, we do have a number of questions that have already been brought forward from the audience, and we'll definitely get to those at 8 o'clock. But the folks who put together this topic list also wanted to break things up a little bit by asking some yes or no questions, just flat out yes or no. So I have a couple of those, and I think I'll pause now before moving on to zero waste as a topic to ask you, Josh, if you believe that climate change is human caused.
Absolutely.
Tim, what's your response to that question?
Yes.
Okay. And currently, people who have rooftop solar in Longmont pay a higher monthly fee than other power users. Do you support removing that fee? Tim, you first.
Tonight. I would support removing it tonight.
Okay. And Josh?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you both so much. Moving on to zero waste, as you know, other recent activity, or it was in 2016, that the Longmont City Council adopted in its sustainability plan unanimously to establish a goal of increasing community-wide waste diversion to 50% by 2025. Currently, the city is recycling, composting, and diverting about 31% of the waste. So pretty good, but a ways to go to reach that 50% by 2025. Do you think this is an important goal, and what steps would you recommend to accelerate that or make sure that the city does meet that goal by 2025? Josh.
So this is not a yes or no question.
No, this is not a yes or no question.
It was a tricky little segue there. We could do yes or no questions all night. Well, first I want to applaud our previous council for getting composting going. You know, I think this was a big first step towards moving us towards that 50% goal. We have a problem first, which is that we're below state average for diversion, and we need to get back on track and be a leader in this. Two, I have experience with diversion. I'm gonna tell you something. When you have 15,000 folks show up to Roosevelt Park, what you do is you create a small city for a day. You bring in power and electrical, you bring in waste and everything you need to run a city, security, money, and commerce. And one of the things you gotta do is you have to have a good waste plan, and we have experience. I have at least 15 diversion reports from EcoCycle directly. This has been a priority for me, and the higher the number, the better. And so I'm all on board with that. This is also about education. So I applaud previous city council getting it on the radar with the opt. I always confuse them with the opt-in option. I'm a member, I hope all of you are too. But I wanna see us get to the opt-out option, but it's gonna take some time. You know, we gotta like experiment, get it, figure it out, make sure it's not that big scary monster in the room, and then move that dial a little bit further. It's about education both to our voters. We need to recognize that composting, just as one example of a way to head in this direction, sustains itself. It's not costing anyone else any revenue, is not taking any tax dollars except for those who are using it, paying for it there. And then we need to get into schools. So the more that we can make our schools zero waste, we start that education process and that expectation that we as humans need to be thoughtful for our environment.
Tim.
I'll just pick it up right where Josh left off and concur that there needs to be outreach to the school district, so we have more than 8 schools participating in the composting project. We need all the schools in the school district participating. The city needs to continue zero waste events, so when we have a city event, they're setting the example for what this looks like. And in terms of setting the example, I have looked, I know the city set a goal to establish, to actually be the example, to be the leader, the city itself and the council. But I've had a hard time finding the baseline. There's a reference in the plan to the city setting a baseline number. And for the life of me, I can't find the baseline number for the city plan. But if I could, then we'd have a pretty good idea of what the target might be and what kind of progress the city can make over a period of time. So I think that's an important step. Multifamily units, apartment complexes right now, don't participate at the same level of residences, and we ought to make that easier as well as businesses.
Okay, and any response or rebuttal? Josh?
No, I was just going to make sure that I touched on the obligation and the role of businesses getting involved too. I work for Left Hand Brewing Company, and back when there were discounts and incentives to get the solar panels up on top, guess what? We did that, and we were one of the first businesses in town to do it, and I think we need to continue to put expectation on the businesses to fulfill their role in not just recycling, but also composting. And there isn't a good system right now in Longmont for business to compost. And then lastly, in the end, the dollars will get those businesses on board. The more that we can incentivize, and by that I mean the more that we can do to make composting and solar panels and renewable energy beneficial for businesses, the quicker they are to jump aboard. In the end, the dollars talk when you're in the conference room.
Okay, thanks so much. Before we actually go into the topic of fracking and the question, the lengthier response that we're looking for on the topic of fracking, we do have a yes or no around fracking, so I think this is a good time to ask it. Are you in support of the statutory initiative which would require a 2,500-foot setback from houses, schools, playgrounds, and sources of drinking water for fracking operations? And Tim, I'll ask you to answer that first.
Yes.
And Josh?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you both. And the question regarding fracking, just a little background that everybody's familiar with, but as everyone's aware, in 2012, Longmont voters voted, as a couple of other communities in Colorado had, to ban fracking operations within the city limits. The state Supreme Court subsequently overturned that ban, and there has not been successful legal action since that. And as a result, there are many permits that are being applied for, and activity, fracking activity, proposed for as far north as Quail Road on the southern end of the city, and of course the concerns about drilling at Union Reservoir. So the question is if you are elected to the city council, what role will you advocate for Longmont in this area of fracking, as well as regulation of flow lines and pipelines? So Tim, I think actually this is you first.
I want to commend the council to begin with for having shown up at the state capitol last week to support the Matt Jones bill to vest authority, or to grant authority to local jurisdictions to control what happens within city boundaries. So that needs to continue, and I would look forward to the opportunity to work with council to advocate on behalf of that kind of legislation. Beyond that, I would, with the council, be asking staff to bring options for consideration by the council for ordinances that would create new regulations for new regulations of gathering and flow lines. We know we have those issues right now in this community. I know that Mike Foote, our representative, has been in the process of building some momentum for local jurisdictions, for cities. For city councils with their communities, to screw up the courage to create the regulations, to create fee structures for operators, whether it's a carbon fee or a pollution fee or a noise fee, you can label it whatever the fee might be, but to create a fee that is significant enough that it's going to cause operators to think twice before speculating in anything that's close to a border. And if there is horizontal drilling that we can't control from outside the city limits, that at least the city residents would benefit if the minerals from under that city limit is going to be extracted. But first and foremost would be to get way more aggressive with regulation of flow lines, specifically with what it's going to cost somebody if they want to drill, as well as inspections and those kinds of things, if they're going to drill underneath our city limits.
Thank you, Tim. Josh Goldberg.
Yeah, let me start by saying that I voted for the ban, and I'm proud of it, and I hope all of you did too. There's no room for oil and gas in our town, and I'll do everything I can to keep it as far away and outside of our town as possible. I am a big believer of bringing the players to the table. In fact, I was just so inspired this morning by when I read the paper and I read that council said, let's meet with the developers to talk about inclusionary zoning and how best to address our affordable gap. And by not bringing the biggest players to the table, you're missing out on an opportunity to have a robust discussion. And I think the players that made that happen in the room are here today. And I just want to say thank you to council. And I would do that with our oil and gas industry. We need to stop. We should not be making decisions without sitting down with them and having a discussion, laying out our expectations, and doing what we can to have them see it our way, and then work with them to find commonality and a way for folks to get what they need, but not to have oil and gas and drilling in our town. And I'll stand by that till the end. There's a couple initiatives happening. Next, I'll stand by our state legislators. Matt Jones, I would have been down there waving my fist too. We need to recognize that right now the power is a state level issue, and we need to put pressure on Jonathan Singer, on Matt Jones, and do everything we can to enable them to be more successful to change, to address this problem on the state level. I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
And Tim, do you want to say anything further? So I just have a brief follow-up on that. We did talk about renewable energy and the city's goal to have 100% renewable by 2030. What role or impact, if any, relationship do you see between accomplishing that goal and addressing fracking?
Could you repeat it?
Yeah. So given the city's goal to have 100% renewable by 2030, do you see that, accomplishing that goal, as influencing or contributing to the solution of the fracking problem? And if you do, can you discuss that? Yeah, Josh, you go first. Yeah, thanks. Thank you, Tim.
I think I'll address this by recognizing that we, as a society, are reliant upon natural gas, and we need to the behavior needs to change from right in here. I'm the proud new owner of a brand new hybrid that I purchased today from Staff Toyota. But that it can't just be hybrids that you pull into your garage. We need to become less dependent on oil and gas as people, and that will help make the pulling the Band-Aid off and heading towards renewable energy easier. And we need to work on education so that working to make our city more renewable energy friendly whilst weeding out oil and gas in our lives a greater reality.
Yeah, it seems to me that to the degree that the city can set the example for making this conversion, and that it's more affordable and healthier to make the conversion to renewable energy is a place to start. It's going to we hear the mantra all the time those people who are just interested in renewable energy, they don't understand that you can't live without gas and you can't live without oil. And I've had some of that feedback, like he must walk to work if he's opposed to fracking. I have had some of that on my website, the feedback. But I do think we have to systematically help to educate the community about the economics of this, that it in the long run, it's way less expensive to make this conversion. It's way healthier to make this conversion, and we have to make it way easier to make this conversion with a kind of infrastructure in this city that allows people who want to drive not just hybrids but electric vehicles, make it easier and more affordable for them to charge their vehicles and to get around the city.
Okay, thank you both. Moving on to the topic of land use, the Longmont Zoning Ordinance has a category for designated agricultural land, and Envision Longmont discusses the need and importance of preserving Longmont farmland in Longmont as traditional use of land here for many, many generations going back. Yet zoned farmland does not show up on the Envision Longmont land use map, and there does not seem to be yet a current plan to preserve farmland as stated. If you're elected to city council, what will you do to preserve farmland in Longmont, and why? And I believe it's Josh's turn to start. Thank you.
Thank you. I've been serving on Planning and Zoning Commission now for 6 years, and this has brought a wonderful wealth of experience for me. We have the pleasure of reviewing into the wee hours of the night, when most of you are asleep, little tiny words that address our Envision Longmont Comprehensive Plan, land use code, sign code, you name the code, there's a code for it, and it takes a lot of work to review. I've been doing this now for 6 years and addressing these issues. What we need to recognize is that I think prioritizing agricultural zones, while we become an increasingly desirable and wonderful place to live, is there's friction there. This is going to be a challenge. We're watching our population grow from 92 or 93,000, and we're set to be hitting 125,000 before you know it. I would look forward to working with folks and hearing back from the public on how we can and where we should be preserving this agricultural land. But it's not easy. It's not the solution for preserving agricultural land will not come up in this room. It will take experts, it will take city staff, it'll take consultants, and it'll take strategy for helping us see where Longmont will be 10 or 20 years down the road, and where we should be preserving agricultural space versus where we should be growing mixed use opportunities in higher density locations.
The planning staff in the city has done a good job of updating land codes to reflect the results of Envision Longmont. The new comprehensive plan is translating into new land code update of land codes. That's good work. But I sat through an hour and a half study presentation before a council meeting. Then I sat through another hour and an hour and a half, and God bless the council members who've gone through this and have had great questions for the staff. But here's, if the question is, what would I bring to the council? I would bring, I think, a different set of questions. I have sat through those sessions and wondering, what's the big picture here for the council? What does the council want to see as a result of the land code updates? What will be different a decade from now or 2 years from now as a result of those land code updates? And how does that vision for the future, how should that be reflected, or how do these land code, the updated land codes, help create that vision? The absence of that vision is going to create, continue, I think, to contribute to some confusion about how serious we are, whether it's agricultural land or any other land use in the city of Longmont. So the work is worthwhile. I'm not being critical of the work. It's good work, and this council has stayed with it seriously to help move that along. I think there's a bigger picture that we all would like to hear about what is the why, what's the big picture, and how does this help get us there? And in that conversation is where we ought to be talking about the various uses and how these codes help to create that.
Go ahead, yeah.
Tim, I applaud you for sitting through an hour and a half study session. I just did the math. I apologize if you saw me grab my calculator. I spent 180 hours at Planning and Zoning Commission in the council chambers, honored to be sitting beside six other folks who are probably smarter than me, attorneys and lawyers, and which are the same, of course, architects and experienced planners. But I have 180 hours of experience there doing exactly what we're talking about. I've worked alongside Chairman Chernak, Scott Dunn, Chairman Pierce, and if you want to see experience and commitment to making sure we're adjusting the land use code or the sign code or traffic regulations or what have you, then please come down on the third Wednesday every night and join us. It's a blast. And you have to love this town to geek out on land use code.
Okay.
Follow up. I want to commend Josh and the Planning and Zoning Commission for all those hours, and I know it's hard work and it's thankless work. But at some point, I hope the Planning and Zoning Commission would be the leader on this conversation and raise the question, what can we be doing there to make certain there isn't confusion or fear about what we are doing with land use in land that's zoned agricultural? Because I think part of the concern is that it appears to many people that that process generally results in approval of proposals to continue to construct on what was otherwise agricultural land. And we know we have housing shortages that we're going to continue. I want to stop development in this community. I think clarity on where we're going as a community and the vision for that is what we need, the kind of leadership we need out of the commission and out of the council.
Okay, thank you so much. So this is obviously an important topic. We do have a number of questions on housing, and I think I'll wait because there are two of them. We'll get to that toward the end. We're going to move on to food and food systems now. Longmont Food Rescue is out and about, and according to their data that they've collected, hundreds of pounds of food are thrown out every single day by city food restaurants and other retailers. At the same time, many Longmont residents lack access to fresh food, to healthy food, and some people live in food deserts out east. The Longmont Sustainability Plan does have as one of its objectives supporting locally based and environmentally responsible and healthy food system that makes sure that all citizens have access to affordable and healthy food. What are some of your ideas of how Longmont can work toward this objective?
Am I first?
Yeah.
Well, we know that there are a number of community gardens now that local groups, churches, nonprofits are actively involved in a kind of farm-to-table or garden-to-table initiative. specifically and sharing the abundance of what's being produced with the community. So whether it's the city's role, I think probably is, at least to be a catalyst to make better connections between those involved in community gardens, the nonprofit community, and the faith community, those who are already involved in helping address the issue of supply and quality of food in a more systematic and strategic way.
Josh.
I hate to do this to you, but would you repeat the question one more time?
No.
I just want to make sure I answer the question.
Sure. So, preface had to do with Longmont Food Rescue, and their data that reveals that hundreds of pounds of food are thrown out every single day here. Part of the Longmont Sustainability Plan is to support the creation of a system of food distribution here in Longmont that would ensure that everybody, all citizens, have access to healthy and fresh food.
Great. Has anyone been to the new Hour Center? The new Hour Center is an incredible facility, and I wish you could see our homeless and underserved community walk through their little grocery store with their cart and do their own shopping with their personal shopper. This is a wonderful example of how organizations like the Hour Center, Community Food Share, Food Rescue are making a difference on our residents right now. But I do think there's opportunities to improve. First, as you suggested, we need to make sure that we have good, healthy food accessible throughout town. That includes in areas where we have minorities, that includes our older adults. Our older adults need to be able to get to good food and back. I applaud the Longmont YMCA. I worked with the Longmont YMCA when they were building out their garden in the back of their facility, and it was neat to see all the folks from Google come down and help work to give our community one more community garden. I think there's a couple opportunities to better implement our food, our wasted food working. If you've ever been down to the farmers market, we have folks collecting food there. What seems like an obvious opportunity would be to tap into our school district. I'm sure there's a ton of food left over at the end of the day, but then we get into the tricky situation, which is food handling requirements. You know, I'm looking, I see a lunch lady in the audience right now, and she'll tell you how much food they have at the end of the day. If there was a way we could respect food handling safety, we'd have a ton of food. And so finding opportunities to distribute food healthfully, safely, and to get it in the hands of those folks who are having trouble getting to it, I'd be in support of.
Anything further on that? Okay. Following the 2013 flood, as everybody is aware, the many, many residents were displaced, and the river itself and all the damage that was caused has posed quite a challenge still to residents of Longmont. But there are a lot of decisions ahead of how and whether to develop the St. Vrain Corridor, how to best do that. If you are elected to council, what would your position be on developing along the St. Vrain River? And Josh, that's for you first.
Excuse me. No joke. Rebuilding the St. Vrain blueprint is by far our biggest project as far as expenses and undertaking. It's 4 years in the making, and it impacts our town from east to west. I am a pro-environmental guy who loves to do whatever we can to protect animals and habitats from light and sound impacts. But my time on planning and zoning and just being a resident in this town and watching our town grow, I also have a little bit of a pragmatism here, which is I respect that on occasion, opportunities for development along these river corridors could be a neat opportunity for our town as far as cultural gathering places, bike paths, walking centers. If you've seen the latest St. Vrain blueprint, it's so exciting what's happening on the north side of the river behind Harvest Junction with the nature hikes and those sort of opportunities. And I want to continue doing whatever I can to help nurture the city to continue building those out. I was asked one time at a forum if I would be willing to sign a strictly no variance along the corridor agreement, and I don't think that's good smart governance. I think when we're talking about this resource along our city, that runs through our city, we need to be careful making any broad statements that say, we'll never build. I think we need to, as is always the case, carefully review projects before us, not close the discussion before we can even begin, and be protective of habitats, turn to our environmentalists for guidance, but be nimble enough when the right opportunity comes to bring a new resource to our town.
So most of us in this room are familiar with the Resilient St. Vrain project, mitigation of the effects of the flood. That project will continue for the foreseeable future. I'm certain an end date, or at least an estimated end date, and I don't know exactly what the estimated end date is. But I do know that in the process right now, we're spending $120 to $130 million of our money, tax money, to mitigate the effects of the flood. And the results, I think, will be spectacular, and we can see some of the effects already. So here's where I am. We have the Resilient St. Vrain Plan, and we also have the blueprint. The Resilient St. Vrain Plan is the mitigation. It's the restoration of the riparian corridors of the floodplain and the channel itself. The blueprint is to guide development. So here's my position. We shouldn't do anything with the blueprint, start making decisions about development, until we're finished with the Resilient St. Vrain Plan. We want to restore the river, and with the 150-foot setback, which is part of that, and then finish the blueprint to guide development. And in that process, I don't think I've ever anybody say that you wouldn't have anything inside the 150-foot setback, because there are already businesses inside the 150-foot setback that aren't going to go away. My position is that the only group at the end of the day, if there is going to be a variance to the 150-foot setback, the only group that should be authorized to grant that variance is the city council. It should not be planning and zoning. It shouldn't be any other council. It should be the group that meets under the scrutiny of the public every Tuesday night and is held accountable by the community to decide if there's going to be a variance. They're the ones who are going to make it.
Josh, do you have a response to that?
Just a short one.
Okay.
The role of city council is not to micromanage. And I think we need to be cautious when voters speak and council heads a different direction. When advisory boards make a recommendation and council goes a different direction. And so I'm not so quick to say that this decision should be made by city council. I think we need to respect that we have commissions from golf advisory boards to airport advisory boards. I know there's some folks here in this room that I think that our liaison to the airport advisory board is here. We have so many advisory boards, and these are folks who are committed to deal with these projects in and out, and I do think that PNZ might be a good place to make a recommendation on that build out. And then, of course, it's a recommendation to council, and council will have the final word. This is kind of the hierarchy of our government.
Do you want to?
Yeah, I would. Recommendations are just those, and if these are recommendations to council, that's where the decision ought to be made. But protecting $130 million investment and our interest, we will have enhanced the value of the private property along the river in ways that no one else could have done except through the commitment of our tax dollars. Protecting the public investment is not micromanaging. That's the job of the elected officials.
Okay, thanks so much. The next topic is smart growth, and several hundred acres of Longmont and adjacent land are already in the permit, the application permit for annexation, or have already been approved for annexation and development. Most of these apparently are single-use residential projects. Meanwhile, there's congestion on the roads and just a lot of overgrowth and all of the attendant impact that expansion has on communities. How can Longmont adopt a more sustainable approach to development that will include mixed-use, walkable, and bikeable communities to mitigate the impact of people? And I think Tim, are you first on this one?
Yes, I think
good.
I am.
Thank you.
The work of Planning and Zoning Commission, that's where those the proposals are coming. And again, I applaud the work that goes on there. As I've gone through and read minutes from Planning and Zoning Commission meetings, it seems to me that there are times when questions would be asked, like when a traffic engineer includes the result of his or her study in a proposal, that the Planning and Zoning, and there's a comment that there are going to be traffic congestion issues as a result of this project, and the project gets approved, or at least recommended, well, it's approved at that point by Planning and Zoning, without anybody asking questions about how long it's going to take, what it's going to cost, who's going to pay for it, and what's going to be the solution. Those are the kind of questions we need Planning and Zoning to be asking at that time. So everybody who's going to be affected by this knows what the timeline is. It seems also to me that Planning and Zoning, there was a time when Planning and Zoning expected more from developers to take care of the infrastructure, not totally on their dime, but to make that investment up front, knowing that there will be accumulation of funds and there will be reimbursements. But I've read too many sets of minutes where that option exists in front of the council to do the infrastructure, including bike paths and walking paths, and the developers get a pass. And the consequence is that we privatize a profit and socialize the congestion that's going to occur for the next however many years, waiting for funds to be accumulated to take care of the infrastructure. Those have to be synced up in a different way. I believe it can be done. It has been done historically without stopping development and without crippling developers. It simply has a matter of pacing development and infrastructure more strategically.
I love talking about planning and zoning. It's been one of the honors of my life to be a part of it, and I can't wait to serve you furthermore on City Council. There's clearly a problem, and I think the problem lies with Jane Madrid. Jane Madrid is the gal who takes the notes at Planning and Zoning, because there is definitely a problem here. I've heard this both from a former city manager and now from someone who's running for City Council, that we're not interrogating and questioning our traffic studies and our traffic engineer, Tyler Stamey. Man, Tyler and I have spent many of uncomfortable minutes going back and forth about why everyone in the audience is upset with him and why he thinks his traffic study is right when everyone else thinks he's wrong. The reality is, when it comes to traffic studies, which no one likes, is that we have to adhere by these nationally governed traffic studies, and they have algorithms that tell us how many cars and vehicles come in and out of a property. And in the end, when a property is impacting your neighborhood, it's never quite as many trips, it's never quite as many, as high of a number as you want it to be when you're fearful of it hitting your backyard. I think, just to respect the question, I do think that we can be doing lots of things. I think we should be prioritizing a dynamic, mixed-use opportunities along our transportation corridor, that's Main Street and our major arterials. It doesn't make sense to put affordable housing way out where you'd have to drive into the grocery store, to downtown, to retail, what have you. One more thing we do on Planning and Zoning is we review the multimodal transportation plan, and that's under review right now. And this is where we focus on connecting the dots so that we can get older folks, young folks, rich folks, and poor folks to be able to get connected in and around our town. The final piece I'll say is, if you need to know an actual statistic, I know the guys that get a hold of to give you the information.
Go ahead, you have a minute.
Just maybe as a as a follow-on, I've gone back and looked for the last time a development project was halted because of a traffic study. And I'm still looking for one example for the last time a development project was halted because of a traffic study. So I have asked the question of our planning department whether or not it would make sense, rather than developers to hire the traffic study, for the city to charge the developer, it's cost the developer the same amount of money, and have the city engage the traffic engineer to do the traffic study, on the off chance that maybe, if the city's paying the bill, you get a different kind of recommendation. You probably wouldn't get different data, but you might get a different recommendation. Now, I was asked, why would I care about that, or why would the city want to do that? Because the developer takes the responsibility for that now. And my response was, you would do that for the taxpayer. You would do that for me. You would do that for anybody whose life is going to be affected by this. That might be a different effect if the city did the hiring.
Go ahead, you have a minute, yep.
If you are so inclined, please go to cityoflongmont.com or org. Does anyone know the actual address? Maybe the mayor should. Check out our website, find the P&Z meeting minutes, and check it out, and then we can put this to rest. That said, I just want to clarify one thing, and that is, actually, I agree with Tim. Tim brought this up. He said, how come we don't have the developers pay the city staff to do the study? And I said, well, dang, that's a good idea. So I went down and I spoke to Joni Marsh, who's in charge of that department, and I said, why do we do it like that? And she said, well, just let me remind you, they're paying a third party who has their integrity to uphold and is, you know, it's set up so that they don't have the skin in the game, if you will. But I said, could we switch this where you have your traffic study company and the developers pay you for that? And she said, sure, let's talk about that. So I'm on board with that idea.
Okay. So a relevant follow-up question here from the audience, and it was very thoughtfully written out, so I'm going to read the whole thing. Landowners, developers, and home builders seeking annexation are constantly coming to Longmont because they gain great value from the city's excellent water and sewer infrastructure, electrical system, and transportation system. Why should the community not expect these business people, to give back to the community by providing affordable housing? So Josh is going to start that one.
They should.
I concur they should. This wasn't a yes or no, was it?
No, this is not a yes or no. This is a bona fide question. You got 2 minutes.
They should. And yet, if we go and read those minutes, there's a project right now. And there is there's a project that's proposed for annexation, and there is some affordable housing, I think Habitat Homes, in this proposal. But if you go back and read the minutes, you would hope to see on annexation proposals consistently the question or the expectation or a presentation of what developers would do to ensure a certain number of affordable housing units, and we simply don't see it in those minutes. And that's simply a matter of taking the initiative, being clear on the expectation, and providing some leadership to the council or to the commission.
They should. That said, I think we need to do a couple things. One, we should make sure we're bringing them to the table to figure out the best way to get the most affordable housing possible out of our developers, and make sure we're not also putting up a red flag that says, hey, don't come help us build out to this town and city that we love and that needs to accommodate those as our numbers grow. During my time on planning and zoning, we've approved four affordable housing unit properties, unanimous decisions, so we're working on it. It kind of, first the developer and the landowner has to want to do it. We're working to make it as easy as possible and incentivize it as much as possible for them. And so I think we need to be open to those opportunities, and I'm willing to do that. The last thing, and if we're going to have an honest discussion about affordable housing, we do just need to recognize that if we're trying to take care of the nurses and teachers and police officers and firefighters, that we need to remember that when we do inclusionary zoning, only a small percentage, 10 or 15% of those units are going to be affordable, and those are going to be based off of your area median income. And according to Don Haddad, just today, he said most teachers do not qualify for those affordable units. Now, what is the impact of making those 10 or 15% of those units more affordable? The other 85 to 90% of those units are more expensive. Well, guess where our teachers and our police officers and our firefighters are? They're in that, folks. Those are the folks that are trying to get into the housing income. They have, maybe there's a second income in their household, so they don't qualify for the deed restricted units, but now the other units are more expensive and perhaps even unattainable Maybe you have a daughter or a grandchild who's trying to get in the housing market, and recognize, it doesn't mean it's a game stopper, but recognize the rest of those units will become more expensive, and we need to make sure we're comfortable with that.
There is a follow-up question that we got via our Facebook stream from a citizen watching on Facebook. And the question is, do either of the candidates support using recycled products for low-income and affordable housing? Materials, I guess, is what they're talking about. So it's, you know, maybe yes or no, and maybe a little more if you want to ask that, if you want to answer that, if you've even heard of that as an idea. What do you think of that idea?
Whose turn?
Tim?
Well, I would think the first question I would have is about health and safety and making certain that whatever's constructed meets expectations. But if it's an option to use recyclable materials, reduce cost, and provide a quality environment, then I would say yes.
And to the person who submitted the question, neat. What a neat idea. I haven't had that come up before. I think, to Tim's point, it just can't be second-rate materials. We have to make sure that those who are most vulnerable in our community, that we're not putting them further at risk. And so that includes the type of materials we're using to build affordable housing. That includes the type of paint we're putting on the walls. And that also includes where we put them. We need to be very careful making sure that we're not putting affordable housing units in high-risk areas that might be, you know, near closed oil wells or in any other sort of environmentally unsteady locations. So I'm down for being as creative as we can to make affordable housing units better and to better utilize recyclable materials. It just has to be safe. It has to be smart. It can't be second-rate. There you go.
Okay, thanks. So I have another yes or no question to make sure that we ask you all of them as we're sort of getting close to the top of the hour here. Have either of you accepted campaign contributions, or will you in the future, from oil and gas companies or their affiliates? Josh?
Sure. Yes. I have accepted, and I'm okay with that. I need to, what is best for our town, as your pro-Longmont guy, is that I get on board. Now, I have sat on planning and zoning in a position where we're approving or denying projects, and along the way, you develop relationships, whether at PNZ, whether at Chamber of Commerce meetings, whether at After Hours, whether from our charitable events. I've worked with Habitat for Humanity developers helping build a home, the house that Beer built, actually. Yes, I have accepted contributions from developers, and that's okay.
It's oil and gas.
And I'm doing that to help make our town better for the future.
Was that a yes?
It was oil and gas. Was the question?
Oh,
yeah.
I thought it was developers.
No, it was oil and gas.
No, I'm not accepted from oil and gas.
Would you change your answer? No, I have not accepted money from oil and gas, nor have I accepted money from developers. And just for anybody in the room. Josh suggested you go, just go to the city of Longmont and just click on the website. If you go to departments, if you go to city clerk and you check on election information, you can look at we filed the reports on Tuesday. You can look for all three of the candidates. You click on the first report, you get a spreadsheet that shows every expense, it shows every contribution from every person or every entity. You won't find a single donation to my campaign except from individuals within the limits of the ordinance.
So you can have an extra minute if you'd like.
Sorry. I apologize. I misheard the question. I have not received any contributions from oil and gas. And when you go to that website and find those contributions and you see those naughty developer contributions, you just have to know that in order to do a campaign in this town, you need money, and when you have a proven track record for being a good person, a good advocate for our town, you get support from everyone. And that's why you'll see you have more contributions. I have more contributions than Tim, and that's why I'm going to win this thing.
Do I get to rebut that?
You do. To be fair, I just. Yeah.
I wasn't putting this in the good people, bad people category, but do the math. Add up all the donations from donors other than individuals, and you'll see more than 30% of one candidate in this race being supported by developers and 0% of donors by me or supporting me. So you decide, and you can make your own judgments from there.
Okay. So the last topic we have before we go to sort of two other topics, one is the sustainability plan and the other is fast tracks, and then we have a couple more audience questions, is bees and pollinators, bees. And it's not a yes or no question whether you're for or against bees, but it's more. Yeah, did you take any money from any bee packs, right? But two of the things that people are really concerned about when they're talking about pollinators has to do with habitat loss and pesticide overuse. And what suggestions do you have for how the city can reduce use of pesticides and preserve habitat for all species?
Who goes first?
Tim.
So a couple comments. I don't know the degree right now that every bit of watered city property also is seeded with white clover, but every square inch should be, because that's a restoration of bee habitat, number one. Number two, there's no question that the category of pesticides that are most toxic and lethal to pollinators. So there ought to be a prohibition, an ordinance, or whatever the prohibition needs to be from the council to ensure that there none of those pesticides are used as we spray for mosquitoes or other insects. Third, when the spraying occurs, I know we do that at night to try to minimize the effects on pollinators, but that needs to be adhered to seriously. And fourth, there is, believe it or not, a bee pledge or a pollinator pledge, right? Jurisdictions, school districts, cities, state agencies around the world are committing to protect the habitat of pollinator populations, and they start by taking the bee pledge or the pollinator pledge, which is ought to be the first step that our council takes.
Thank you, Josh.
Yeah, I want to applaud city. The city staff has been working with the Pollinator Action Network, and I'm supportive of everything that David Bell has been doing, and I think we should vow to be a pollinator-safe city. And so I'm on board with that. And I think actually, Tim, the city already has that ordinance in place. They're called the neonics. There's a multi-syllabic word that I don't know how to spell, but it's shortened to neonics. The neonics pesticides are not being used in town. And so I applaud the city staff and helping us get there. I think the next thing, Tim mentioned a bunch of good ideas, but we need to also recognize that weeds aren't bad, especially if they're managed and cared for. So I think we need to be less concerned about making sure we're preventing all weeds. We just need to make sure that they're groomed, and the city has taken efforts to loosen up any compliance or issues relating to weeds growing out of hand. They just have to be managed, and I think this is a step towards making sure we're not impacting our pollinators.
Anything further, Tim? Okay. All right, well, we're just a couple minutes shy of 8 o'clock and moving along on schedule here. I do want to ask you about the Longmont Sustainability Plan. Just a reminder, this is a city plan that was adopted in 2016, the sustainability plan. The three pillars of that plan are environmental protection, responsible economic growth, and social equity. Please discuss how you would support a strong implementation of the Longmont Sustainability Plan, and what would a sustainable Longmont look like to you? What is that vision?
So now we moved on to 3 minutes.
Correct. Thank you for the reminder of that. Thanks. These last two questions. Thank you. And Josh is first, correct? Yeah. You're great. Thank you so much.
Okay, I think I heard three things in there. Environmental protection, economic growth.
Responsible economic growth and social equity.
And social equity. Mm-hmm. I think we've touched on a lot of these issues today. You know, as it relates to environmental protection, we've talked about the build-out of the river corridor, and I'm in favor of doing everything we can to protect that river corridor, nurture the and support the habitats that are there, decrease water sound and light impact on those habitats, but also, and I know it might not be that popular, be nimble for unique opportunities for unique opportunities down the line that might involve infringing upon that riparian setback. Why? Because that gets to our second one that's so important, which is responsible economic development. So what we have here are things that sometimes seem to be going against each other. Environmental protection, social equity, and economic growth. These, like, almost if you looked at them one at a time, you'd say maybe they're not compatible, but they are. So making sure that we're doing what we can to have the flag raised that Longmont is open for business. This is we cannot undervalue the role of jobs in our town. We need to have good jobs, interesting jobs, dynamic jobs. We need to be drawing in good businesses, good corporations with high-paying jobs, and the city needs to continue to do what they can to work with those businesses as they come in, supporting the Longmont Economic Development Partners, working with the Chamber of Commerce to help get as good return from these businesses as possible. Just look at Smucker's as an example. 300 or 400 jobs, all of them averaging, with the city requiring them to hit $49,000 in average salaries. This is good economic development, and we need to have these good discussions. And I would look forward to that and be supportive of that, and my time on Chamber of Commerce supports that. And then social equity, we've talked about making sure we're doing anything we can to bring in and nurture and grow the role and the involvement of all of our communities, not just the folks look around you, not just us folks in the room, but everyone. So doing our best to better engage and support those organizations that are working with our Latino communities, better engage them in the school district, better engage them on those commissions, and continue to allow more access to all of the parts of our town that makes it great to everyone and to folks of all income and colors.
Well, I think the question is more specifically tied to the triple bottom line of sustainable development that puts people and planet or the environment on an equal level with profit. So if I were to take those, pick off those, if the components, if you dissect the social equity component or the people component, there are specific criteria that are at least at this moment laid into part of an assessment tool, or what could be assessment tool, for scoring new proposal developments based on the effects on people. And when the effects are not what you would prefer to see, there are offsets to mitigate those effects. I mean, that the communities that are serious about sustainable development have developed scoring systems that do just that. New proposal development comes along. The first step the developer is going to take is subject their proposal to a scoring system that focuses or addresses the three bottom lines. That all the components of social equity are going to be addressed with offsets if there's a negative. Same thing with the environment, with offsets if they're negative, and metrics to score. If the developer doesn't do well, it doesn't work either. It has to be profitable for the developer, but not at the expense of the environment or of the population. So there are good examples in the country or in the Northern Hemisphere of communities that have developed sophisticated metrics for scoring proposals that at the end of the day results in proposal development projects where the citizenry is better off, not infuriatingly congested, better off as a result, better infrastructure, better access, where the planet is better off, where the environment benefits from development, and where the developers are profitable, where they do well. In fact, they do well enough that the scoring system allows the decision-making process to accelerate decisions about development. At the core, that's what sustainable development is about. And I know that we've made steps with our sustainability plan in those directions. I do wonder, I've seen in the blueprint, in the St. Vrain blueprint, the guide's development, there are components of the sustainability plan that are reflected there. And there's been some attempt to score the blueprint based on the effects on people, the environment, and developers. I've looked for, I've asked about the metrics for this, where they came from, how reliable they are, where they've been used, and I have yet to get answers on those. That's not to suggest they're not there. I just haven't, you know, probably caught up with the right person. The point is, the potential is there for us to continue to develop economically and have our population benefit, our environment benefit, and developers line up because they're going to continue to make a profit.
And Josh, you have a minute back.
Yeah, Tim brings up the triple bottom line at these forums, and I applaud him for it. It's certainly sounds compelling. I think the problem that I see, only because I haven't seen it in real world experience, is when you're evaluating projects and development, and you're reviewing our city based on a point system, I just think there's too many opportunities where it would be hard to rate this point or that point. Is the impact of this affordable housing unit a 4 or a 5? Is the impact as we encroach upon the riparian setback, is that a 2 or a 1? The traffic study says that there won't be negative impact. Well, does that get a 1 because it will have some more development, or a 5 because the perception is that it's going to have great impact? So I think what the point system is doing is removing the humanity, removing the human from our community, with the community being people. So I look forward to seeing more of it, but I would be skeptical.
Yeah.
Okay. So all of you might want to make a note, go Google Canmore Canada, and look at their scoring system. It hasn't slowed down development. In fact, it hasn't taken the human aspect out. What it has done is add a data component to build confidence that we're making good decisions, not inhumane decisions, that are good for the people, good for the environment, and good for the developer. In operation right now, with relatively sophisticated metrics. And that's, in my mind, that's the direction in which we ought to be moving with our sustainable approach to sustainable development.
Okay, thank you both so much. And the next question has to do with the fast tracks. And in 2004, as you know, voters approved an additional 0.4% sales tax to add to the 0.6% sales tax, and that was to fund the fast tracks, which was to go from Denver to Boulder and end up here in Longmont. That plan is not going forward right now. It costs and expense and uncertainty about construction, et cetera. So the question is, do you believe that Longmont should still fight for the promised fast tracks rail? If not, do you have alternative suggestions? Or what other things do you think Longmont should fight for to aid in its current transportation challenges and well plan for the future?
I believe that the city council needs to continue to push the RTD board to deliver on what was promised. So what does that mean? That means we ought to expect to see a plan every year, what their plan is. We ought to expect representatives of RTD to be here and answer our questions. We ought to push it and squeeze as hard as we can. That said, you can't squeeze money out of a turnip if there's no money left, and we all know that that's kind of where we are. So there are some experiments that people are considering. The peak transportation option using BNSF rails for 3 trips in the morning, 3 trips in the afternoon. Not uncontroversial, because there's money that's going to be required to make this work. But I think it's an experiment that's worth testing. That's one of the ways that Seattle got started, is my understanding, with their commuter system. So, you know, that could be done in the relatively near future. I think it's worth an experiment. But at the end of the day, as much as I resent would be the right word, not getting what we were promised by RTD, we need to think about how do we turn lemons now into lemonade. Because at the end of the day, by the time Fast Tracks is going to get to Longmont, commuter rail may not be the solution. It's hard to imagine right now what some of the options might be. And I can attribute to an expert in this room, because I'm not smart enough to have any idea what monorail costs, but I'm told that it's cheaper, more efficient, with way fewer right-of-way issues. It might be a way better option than what commuter rail might have been. Here's the point. We need to be working with RTD. They need to be listening to us, and we need to be envisioning what's the next generation of mass or more mass transit, I guess, for the lack of a better, for mass transit. I don't know that the commuter rail was ever going to be quite as much mass transit as we wanted, but for more efficient transportation from Longmont, both up and down the Front Range. I think we have a chance to seize an opportunity and get ready for what's coming later. I wouldn't pull out. We've got $50 million invested in this. We ought to stay the course. We ought to expect more, and we ought to be planning for what's coming next, and expect that we're going to get something that's bigger and better than what we might have gotten had we had delivered what Fast Tracks promised in 2004.
Josh.
Thank you. Yeah, let me start by, I'd like to applaud one of our council members, Councilmember Peck, for her unrelenting commitment towards bringing Fast Tracks to our town. There's probably not a bigger advocate for helping us get what we want and bringing Fast Tracks to town than Commissioner Peck. Councilmember Peck, I apologize. Yeah, Fast Tracks stinks. And we didn't get what we signed up for, and it's going to be hard to get what we signed up for. And it's not going to happen when most of us would benefit from it the most. So I feel you, and I'll work on accountability with Fast Tracks. There's only so many options available to us, but I'm going to stick with it and hold their feet to the fire till the my last day in office. Yes, there's some kind of second-rate options that have been proposed that we could get sooner. These peak travel rates, 3 in the morning, 3 at night, maybe as soon as the mid-2020s. Mind you, I think it was supposed to be completed, what, in 2016? 2014, yeah. So they're a little behind schedule, and I'll do whatever I can to support that, to help us get there. Yes, peak travel is an option. It's not what we paid for. It's not what we signed up for. And I'll fight for what we signed up for. But bus rapid transit is another option, but it's not as easy as it's set out to be, and it's not what we signed up for. Getting effective transportation on bus is not what the voters paid for starting in 2004. And I would work with Eugene May and Dan Kramer at the city attorney's office to explore any opportunities for getting out of that contract. I know that other folks in this room have spent time working on that, but we've got a ton of money into it. We owe it to our voters and our residents to get what we paid for. And even though the options are closing in on us, we just need to keep milking as much out of that cow as we can, even if it's as simple as continuing to get our free bus transportation within our town. You know, we have folks that are using the bus right now for free. I would look to encourage to get every little drop we can until we get what we pay for.
Do you have a follow-up to that, Tim? Okay. So here's another question from the audience. That does it for the questions, the various topics that Sustainable, Resilient Longmont and EcoCycle put together for you all to address. So thank you so much for your great job doing that. And this is a last audience question, which is, what is your stance on prairie dog relocation? Josh.
Oh, is it my turn? I think we should turn to our neighbor to the south in Boulder for guidance on this. Boulder has an ordinance on how, on options for relocating, donating, and then unfortunately, when necessary, the exterminating options for prairie dogs. This is something that's very sensitive here in Boulder County, and I too am sensitive to it. So right now, the options in Longmont are limited. I would turn to Boulder's ordinance as an option for consideration. In the end, though, when making a decision on how we should move forward with prairie dogs, just as I said earlier, I would need to sit down with experts, with I don't even know who's the expert in prairie dogs, but I would find them, and they exist. And I would look for guidance from those who've been before me and those who are doing it right, and that might be in Boulder, and that's where I would go.
I am somewhat aware of a plan that may, I don't know the degree to which it is a reflection of the Boulder ordinance, but for the humane relocation of prairie dogs. And to the degree that I understand the plan, I am totally supportive of the plan. I know the downside is from some, there's more of an expense to the humane treatment or approach to relocating prairie dog colonies, but from my perspective, that's an investment we're going to have to make and would support the humane approach to the relocation. And the specifics of that have to do with retrieval and the kind of effort that's made and then the options if you're not going to be able to get them relocated.
Okay, and here's another question. We've touched on this a little bit tonight, but I think that there's something in this question that we really haven't addressed, and it's important. So this is the question, it's an audience question. What are your thoughts or plans for public outreach and education, especially for marginalized, poorer populations in Longmont, on the importance of sustainability and the responsible use of resources? And Tim, yeah.
Well, I've spent a good part of my life, half my professional life, in the public sector, and the other half in the private sector, but doing education and public outreach work. It requires a systematic approach to identifying influentials in the community, thought leaders in the community, community leaders in the community, and bringing people together, building the conversation, and looking for those who are adopters, from whom others can learn. There are great examples actually in the world where for almost no cost, significant social change occurs, the adoption of the very kinds of ideas we're talking about or practices we're talking about, by understanding how that process works and systematically identifying those in our community who can work and influence others, and taking the time to help them with their own adoption of the use of 100% renewable energy.
You know, I think this transcends renewable energy. I think this is about engaging our minority population as a whole, and the strategy needs to start with turning to those who are trusted and building relationships with those cultural brokers, Marta Moreno, Jose Beteta, Luis Lopez, Donna Lovato from the Our Center. These, from El Comité, we need to turn to the trusted voices in our town, the trusted representatives of our town, to spread the word. And so bringing them to the table, and then we just can't have the four that I listed. We have to work on building relationships and expanding our relationships within the Latino community and other minorities. We need to make sure all of our materials and education is in Spanish. And did you know that every Sunday morning, our chief butler walks the streets of our neighborhoods and meets and breaks down barriers between our underserved community and those at most risk and our authorities? And I wonder if I couldn't just get him to write down a phone number or an email contact with every hand he shakes so that we could start building our list of cultural brokers, building our list of folks who have been on the other side of the wall, and that can help spread the messaging that we're trying to work with. There's an opportunity here where trusted members of our community are engaging with trusted members of all of our communities, and we need to grow that. This will begin with our cultural brokers, those who are trusted, and then we will be able to spread the good word throughout.
Okay, thanks so much. Well, we are at the end of our debate, and we're going to, each of you candidates, thank you so much again for your thoughtful responses to this wide array of questions, and thanks to the members of the audience for the really good questions that you put forward. Each of you will have, I believe, is it 3 minutes or two-minute closing statement. Macy, I can't thank you enough. You have just been phenomenal. So thank you so much to our timekeeper, and of course to the sponsors of tonight's event, the Longmont Observer, Sustainable Resilient Longmont, and EcoCycle. So with that, we will begin with our closing statements of the candidates.
Well, friends, thanks for sticking to the end. It has been such a journey to work to serve you more. The journey of running for office is just such an honor and such a privilege to be in situations like this, you know? And I wouldn't trade it for anything, and God forbid Tim wins this thing, I'm gonna still hold my head proud and know that this town's gonna be great. And I'll see you down the line. But I think I'm your guy right now. I know many folks here appreciate Tim's life experiences. Man, he's really smart, he's very wise, and he's made a big impact on the world. But I think I'm your guy. I have been committing, for as long as I could, which is the last 11 years, I have been committing to elevate this town that we love so much. Not just in raising a ton of money for charity, but engaging our community folks to be a part of the Longmont story, and serving, boots on the ground, serving, not at the end when I'm ready to retire, but now when I'm still a young dad trying to get it all done and serve the business that I represent to. I'm proven and I'm passionate and I'm committed to helping continue the Longmont story. I'll finish with, I'm a decision maker when the time is right, but I'm comfortable and willing to turn to experts and consultants and staff, and I'm happy to seek the opinion of others before making a decision. I'm a consensus builder. I'll tell you what, if you've watched City Council for the last few weeks, you'll know what I know, which is that we need consensus on that council. And right now, it's contentious, and it's a little scary, and I wanna make sure that we're gonna have a robust, healthy Longmont, not just for us right here, but for my little girls, and then when my little girls have little girls, I want this town to be great, and it's gonna take consensus and the ability to work together, and I think there's a gap for that on our town, on our council, and I'm fiercely loyal to Longmont.
Thank you very much, Josh. Tim.
Okay, well, I appreciate the recognition of life experiences. I've had a few. I've spent decades in the service of others. Josh has, as we've heard a couple times, has done a really great job of raising a lot of money for people who really deserve it, and I give him and Left Hand credit for that. I've spent my life not raising money, but changing lives. And I've done it through improving educational practice and program across the country and outside the country. So it's been a lifetime of service. I've looked for opportunities to bring what I've done in the world to Longmont. I think I heard a minute ago that I'm an old guy in retirement.
No,
I have a fair amount of energy and a lot left to give. So we need cheerleaders and we need advocates. We also need offensive coordinators. Think of me as your offensive coordinator who can lay out a game plan, help you decide how best decide how we want to get someplace, and lay out the strategies to get there. And while I'm old, I would never criticize you for immaturity, Josh. I do think some maturity and some sophistication and some experience with actually building bridges on governing bodies is going to matter in moving this council forward. And if that's what you want, if you want clarity and you want transparency and you want accountability and you want leadership on this council, I'm your candidate. Thank you.
Thank you all so much. Thank you.